I'm Jay Barrett, and this is the Kenai Conversation. And this morning, I have on two very special people, people who are, well, special to their ginormous and growing family, special to the city and special to me. They're very good friends of mine, John and Sharon Williams. Hello, how are you both?
Pretty good, Jay. Thank you for welcoming us out today, and just say good morning to all our friends, Romans and countrymen throughout the entire peninsula.
And I'm very good this morning, too, and I want to wish everybody a Happy New Year and hope they had a very happy, Merry Christmas.
Oh, you know, I should tell people, I've spent a few Christmas days with you folks, and I can only imagine, I mean, back then you had maybe five kids and grandkids. Now there must be, it's been a dozen years since I've been there. Wow, how many
30?
You got now? Oh, are you renting out the rec center for that now?
Still at the house, but we had 30 family members in this year.
That's amazing.
Yeah, they all were here but one. We had a good time. We celebrated our 50th, and they all came in for that and stayed for Christmas, except for a couple.
Wow, yeah, that's great. And I was going to mention your 50th wedding anniversary. You guys had an open house shindig at Paradiso's on Sunday.
Yes.
Which I thought, because of the long weekend, and perhaps I don't remember Saturday, I thought Monday was Sunday.
So did I.
And I showed up there, looking around, like, yeah. Well, imagine my surprise. So, well, happy anniversary to you both.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Jay. It's been 50 years. It started right out in Nikiski 50 years ago, 1968, and it's continued on through all the way up until now.
Wow. Well, tell me how you met. Sharon, are you from California as well?
No.
No, okay. No.
I'm from Washington. My parents moved up, and I thought, oh, I'll go with them. And I kind of liked Alaska, so that was soon my home, too. And then I met John about a year later.
Oh. So, and, well, what year did you come up?
I came up in 67.
Oh, okay.
The spring of 67.
Wow. Schoolgirl?
No.
No?
No. I was working.
So. Man. Well, what did you think of John? Did you meet him here or up in Fairbanks? Or
I met him here.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Did you guys, well, I guess maybe a little chronology would be in order here, because I know you spent a bunch of time up in the interior at Clear Air Force Base and elsewhere. And what's the Air Force Base, Air Force Station?
No, it was, when I first came to Alaska, I was under contract to the government to maintain all the automatic control systems at the five Nike sites and Fort Wainwright, five Nike sites located around Eielson Air Base. So I was on and off of the bases up there. And after the contract ended, I didn't really want to go back to Los Angeles. So RCA, who was the contractor running the ballistic missile early warning system, had contacted me and took my resume, and I went to work out there. I was there 3.5 years. Decided I really needed a change. It's kind of an isolated situation. So I needed a change, so I moved down to Romantic Healy Valley. At that time, the road only went one way. You couldn't go there from this end, and you couldn't, you only had to go back. So we built a power plant there. And on about the 15th of December, 1968, I went back to Los Angeles for a couple months. Late February of that year, 1968, I came to Kenai.
Oh, okay. And did you marry and then move back up to the interior?
No.
Oh, okay.
We did spend a little time. Sharon might mention that, too. We did spend a little time in Fairbanks in between.
Oh, okay. John has told me a lot of stories about renting airplanes, flying into town from up there, and hanging out with his buddies. I guess he was a swinging bachelor then. I did not know that.
He was. And when I met him, well, first let's go back. In 67, there was the Fairbanks flood. And there was a picture of two little girls, twins, with a note pinned on them, being flown out to family out in California. And it grabbed my heart because my little girl was the same age. So I cut that picture out and I kept it. I don't know why. Swing forward to 68, and I was helping my parents move, and I lost my daughter. Well, one of the people at the house took her over to play with their kids, and I'm out panically looking. They said, oh, she's probably with this gentleman. He's got two little girls the same age. And I said, do you have an extra child here playing? Well, no, but I've got a couple here, extra ones. So then about a week later, he asked me to dinner. And during dinner's conversation, we found out that his daughter's pictures was the one I had cut out.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, yeah. So it was kind of a long
wow.
situation.
That's
there.
Almost... what do you call it? Fate. Kismet there.
Together.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
And so what was your reaction when you found that out?
Oh, it was real interesting. You know, it's like, wow. I cut this picture out, and then I meet the man and the kids. And
Months later.
It was almost 9 months, 10 months later.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow. I remember that flood. We lived in Anchorage, and my dad had some friends up there, and they came down and stayed with us for weeks, really.
Yeah. The entire town deserted. I mean, at that time, I think the population in Fairbanks was about 19,000 people, nothing like it is today. And virtually the entire town left, and those of us that stayed behind, we either billeted at the university or in friends' houses that were above the water line. The water line in downtown Fairbanks was over the top of the meters. They had declared martial law. They'd closed all the food supplies down, the markets and everything like that, and they set up lines for those that needed supplies, and they would just ration them out. And it was a very trying time for a lot of people. A lot of people lost everything they had. I remember seeing houses that had caught fire, and they'd burnt down halfway down to the water line, and you could see the tops of couches and chairs that had been singed, and that was the water. The fire stopped at that point, you know.
Mm-hmm. Just like a boat burning to the water line.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow. Wow. Every time I think about or talk about the flood there, I remember the election the next year. It was 68, so it was a gubernatorial year, I'm pretty sure. Wasn't it?
Midterm.
Was it?
66 was the gubernatorial year.
Oh, okay. So 70 then. Uh-huh. I remember seeing all these TV commercials, and the one I remember the most was the guy who founded Carr's Grocery Stores. I don't remember his first name.
Larry.
Larry Carr.
Right.
Larry Carr. He had so many ads on TV about him saving people from the flood, or pitching in, really, you know, and stuff like that. I told my parents, well, you should vote for him. I didn't know anything more about him. Then I saw him on TV, and they were long. They were like 15-minute long things.
Yeah. Larry tried really hard to win that election, and if you remember, Bill Egan won that election. It was actually Bill's third term. It was controversial in that he supposedly had served two terms when he was first elected, but because of some counting methods that they used, he hadn't quite served the entire two full terms. He was a couple weeks short, maybe. So the controversy was, you know, did he serve two full terms? And I think possibly that was what got him unelected, and Wally Hickel won the election in 66. In 1970, Wally had departed for Washington, D.C. in 1968. That may be the year you remember. Nixon had hired him as Secretary of the Interior, and he went back there, and as Wally always said, after he came home, Nixon let him go. He said, I got a turkey for Thanksgiving. But Bill Egan came back again then to run that supposed third time, which was not against the rules at all. After you've set out one term, you can come back. And he fought hard. He fought hard in the primary against K4G. His mind just just slipped my mind. His motto was K4G, which is gold. And Wally Hickel, he won the primary. Egan won the primary, and he beat Larry Carr, and I forget who the others were that were in it now, became governor again. And the next time that I saw Bill Egan, I was a pretty good friend of his, was when we dedicated the brand new fire station in Kenai, and that would have been around 1972, I believe. We dedicated the brand new fire station there, and he came down for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a crowded field. I remember I don't know if it was just I had just gotten to that age, or there were finally three TV channels in Anchorage, so there was, they could air what they wanted, I guess. But it seemed very crowded. That was the year I remember the first time I got tired of commercials. Mm-hmm. And I was, eight years old. And it's like, oh, man, is this ever going to end? Oh, look, Larry Carr is on now. Let's watch this.
I mentioned the K4G. How could I forget? It was Wendell Kay. Wendell Kay was the attorney at the time, and his motto was K, his last name, 4G, governor. And it just turned out the thing that reminds you is the chemical formula for gold is K4G.
Yeah. How did you get into politics? And as soon as you answer that, let me ask Sharon what she has thought about it at the time.
Well, so. I'll start at the very beginning, and I'll end right there, too, so that Sharon might be able to say a few things. But my very first campaign was John Kennedy. 1960 was the first time that I was able to vote. I participated in his campaign. I was there at the Biltmore Hotel the night that he received the nomination, and I was there when Vice President
Johnson
finally, after long and arduous arguing, agreed to accept the vice presidential position, and it was late in the evening. Kennedy went on to make his acceptance speech at the Los Angeles Coliseum, and I was there at that time too. Later after that, I came to Alaska, and of course, being the all of a sudden newborn good Democrat that I was, I fell in with the Democratic Party in Fairbanks, and I played around with their political system for a while. And in 1966 was my first attempt at elected office. I ran for the state legislature, won the primary, lost the general because, of course, Wally Hickel and the Republican side swept the government into power at that time. So I can let Sharon take up from there.
Oh. Well, what did you think about his forays?
Well, when I first met him, he was not in politics at all. And soon after, then we dated and we got married. He then went to work for the college and was there for the next 17, 18 years. That's when he really went into public politics. Before that, he was always involved in whatever, groups, politics, but in a different way. In 1986, retired from the college and got drafted to run for mayor. That was full-time politics for the next 21 years.
Drafted.
There was a group of people that came up with, did they have a petition for you to run? There was something they was...
Well, a group of them came to my office, and I was rather shocked. They mostly were attorneys. And they all came unto the office there, and they said, John, we want you to run for mayor. And I said, well, that's really not my forte. I don't mind serving on committees and kind of, I'd been behind the scenes. I'd been chairman of the Democratic Party down here, and it kind of kept all of the and harbor commissioner for the city. And Vince O'Reilly was in the government at the time, and I thought the world of him. I really wasn't interested in being mayor. But they came and they said, we want you to be mayor. And they had an ulterior motive. They really did. Those attorneys that came to me wanted to see the city attorney dismissed. And that was to have been my primary charge at the time. It was the worst possible time to run for mayor because the oil was at $8 a barrel. The country was in the tank. 30,000 people got up and left the state of Alaska almost overnight. Our housing system went into depression. Foreclosures by the hundreds. And, I mean, it was really a bad time to say, oh, I'm going to come up here and solve all these problems. Well, I finally agreed to go. The very last day for filing, I went in and dropped my paperwork in the desk, and the clerk took it, Janet Whalen, and she said, well, she said, you're missing one document here. But she said, don't worry about it. I'm going to Boston this weekend. You come in on Monday, and Carol Fries is the assistant clerk. Just tell her I said it's okay. Bring the paper in on Monday, and we'll be okay. Well, I came in on Monday, and she delayed her answer a little bit, and she went to see the city attorney, who immediately denied my candidacy on the basis of it being not completed.
Right.
So I said, I'll tell you what, I'm going to run one way or the other now. I said, this upsets me that you have denied my application to run for mayor. So I said, I'll go down to the city council and I'll get them to change the rule. That's how dumb I was to politics. The city council just doesn't change rules. There are election rules. So I went to the city council and I said, look, I'm going to write a write-in campaign. I said, and it's going to be very expensive. I'm going to have to teach everybody how to make out these little slips and how to glue them onto the ballot. And when I said that, the clerk jumped up and she said, oh, don't do that. Those stickers, they gum up the machines. It'll ruin the whole election. Sally Bailey was on the council at the time, and she said, oh, let him run. He can't win anyway. Well, that even put even more perseverance into my mind. I'll show these people. And so I did run. And I beat out the vice mayor, who was Raymond Measles at the time. And history shows that I served at the city for the next 18 years and over at the borough, of course. So that was really how I got there. Not wanting to, forced into it, having failed to complete all of the necessary paperwork. The council had to make a decision, and the attorney, not too long after that, left for other areas.
So. Oh, boy. You seem to have figured out the job, though. How long did that take? You were familiar with the process, though. You've seen the sausage made.
I was very familiar with the process, and not only that, but I knew a lot of political figures in the state because I was deeply involved in behind-the-scenes politics. I've known every governor since statehood on a first-name basis up until Dunleavy. Dunleavy, I'd never met him before. But all the way through Walker, I always had an open door to the governor's office. They were always welcome and keen-eyed, didn't matter which party they were. I worked with all of them. Senator Stevens and I were close associates. Don Young and I have known each other since he was the mayor of Fort Yukon. In fact, here a few months ago, I was in his office, and I have this great picture of he and I shaking hands, celebrating his elevation to dean of the Congress, you know, and we're both laughing about that.
Right.
Knew a lot of the legislators. So I was pretty well set, politically speaking, to help represent the city.
Do you consider the good old days now? Because you mentioned earlier you're working on your memoir. I hope that's not a secret I just let out of the bag.
Well,
but what era is the good old days?
It's really hard to say. You have to look at it from the perspective of which portion of years. The years with the college, the years with the Air Force and the Army, my years in politics, my years as mayor. You have to break them out in groups because they were all great years. It was just what I felt that I was able to accomplish in each of those blocks of time.
Sure. Do you lament anything specifically from each block of time?
Well, yeah, as with everything you do in life, there are always mistakes that you'll make, and sometimes you wish you hadn't have. The greatest political error that I ever made was at the borough mayor's office. I had gotten crossways with a group of people, and I refused to yield. And the result was they mounted a monstrous campaign that wound up with the opposition fabricating all kinds of stories. And, of course, things were a difficult period then, too, because the borough was deeply in debt. And I had to figure out a way how to bring the reserves back, get out of debt. And at the same time, when I'm trying to get out of debt, I've got $100 million worth of capital projects to complete and sometimes short of money to do it. And I accomplished all of those things, built all of those projects, fired several people who were very incompetent at their jobs, you know, just really took on a hard-nosed position. And, of course, that cost me a lot of votes. However, all the projects were finished, and that was what I was well known for. So,
oh yeah, boy, I tell you, I tried to think of some way to fit that into your memoir subtitle there. All the projects I finished.
That would be a good title. Yeah.
Well, Sharon, while John was doing all this, while he was building his business empire as well, while being mayor and stuff. Where were you? What were you doing?
I was
Were you the secret office? The secret power behind the man.
Yes.
She spent many, many, many hours not only looking after grandchildren there in the office, but taking care of the books and the day-to-day operations and making sure the checks got written and, you know, the, all those things that I should have been doing if I'd have been home. The other thing I've always been appreciative of, Sharon, and I've said this to her before, but during those years I was mayor, I was on the road a lot. It was nothing for me to jump up and say, get my bag ready, I'm leaving in a couple hours. I'd go to Washington, D.C., go to Juneau, go to the major meetings of the National League of Cities and all of that sort of thing. Always with an intent of bringing back something viable for the city. And she was always packing my bag, either for a three-day or a week-long trip, sometimes maybe even longer. So many, many years there, she was really by herself. And things would come up with the apartments, and she'd make the decisions what to do and look after the grandkids and await my return with a suitcase full of dirty clothes, so to speak. So
it was funny, we just had all the family there, so we're reminiscing, and one of the grandkids that was always at the office as a little boy, he would always say, Grandma, you don't work. But now he said, oh, that was just so terrible. I knew you were, but he said, I didn't think because I was at the office you were really working.
Oh. Yeah. Oh, boy. And so what were your feelings all these years? Were you did you ever think politics got in the way at all?
Sometimes I did, yes. I traveled a lot with him for the conventions and the different trips. But a lot of his short business trips that he would make for the city, 3 or 4 days, I didn't go on.
One of the things, too, that I regretted, I'm always one for celebrating various issues. Many of my birthdays I spent in Juneau because they came on May the 9th and the legislature was always just about ready to close. I can truthfully say that I have closed more legislative sessions in Juneau than most legislators have.
Yeah.
Because most legislators don't serve for 18 years. And on a couple of occasions, Sharon was fortunate. The timing was just right, and she would go to Juneau with me, and we'd sit in the gallery and close the legislature.
I had his 50th birthday party planned, and it was one of those, quick, get me a bag packed, I'm out of here. Yeah. So he was gone, and the party was canceled.
Oh, no. Man. Well, so Sharon, tell me a little bit about those years from your perspective, the years of building business and watching the kids and grandkids and all the politics.
Oh, it was interesting. It was a lot of fun. Before, go back to the college, because I worked over there too. And then when John retired in 86 from the college, and I had resigned the year before to start taking care of family a little more in a different way. and the wedding started happening, and that was taking time. So I was at the office then. And then he kind of went into the politics, and that was taking him more and more away. And sometimes, yeah, it got in the way, but it was okay. We was able to work around it and work with it. So,
mm-hmm. How old were your brood and their kids during the politics years?
Babies.
Well,
the grandkids.
That was probably part of the saving grace of the whole thing, was that our older children were pretty well raised. John Michael still had 2 years to go in high school when I became mayor. The girls had all graduated and gone on. It was the grandkids. The grandkids started popping up, and as I say, Mom, because of the economic times and everything, the kids, of course, had to work and maintain their position as family units.
In our office, we had like a little alcove, and I had a baby swing and a baby bed there.
Yep, and the grandkids would be pawned off on Grandma, and she would take the time to do all the things necessary to keep them safe, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But they grew up to be very, very responsible people.
Oh, that's good to hear. Do you have great-grandkids yet?
One.
Yeah.
3 years old.
Three?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. She was here, too.
Oh, that's great. How far afield is your family now?
Well, all of them were home. Everyone was home except for Tyler. Tyler is the one missing link, and he's over in Williston, North Dakota. He works in the non-destructive testing group with Akron, who is one of your neighbors here.
Oh, right.
He works out of their office back there, primarily because at the time he received all of his certifications and everything, he came here to try to get a job, and the oil field had crashed. I mean, we lost, 4,000 jobs off of North Slope, and there was no work for him here. So he went to work for Intel down in Chandler, where they make the secret chips for the computers, and was there 8 months, got a couple of promotions and one thing and another, and lo and behold, Akron called him on the telephone. It wasn't sent a letter or something like that. They actually called him on the telephone, asked him how soon he could be in Williston, North Dakota, and he said, what do you mean by how soon? He said, December the 3rd. This is like on November the 15th. He said, I can be there. And in two very rapid, fast days, he drove from Phoenix, Arizona to Williston and took the job there.
Oh, nice. Nice. So then everybody else lives here then now. That's awesome.
No.
Oh.
No. There's only one grandson that lives here.
Oh.
And that's our Ryan. And he's working on the slope. Kippy is a vice president, assistant vice president of the First National Bank now. You remember Kippy mm-hmm. worked here. Debbie is working with a fencing company up in Anchorage, fence company. Donna is deputy clerk of the Federal Reserve or Federal Bankruptcy Court in Anchorage. John Michael is working on the slope. So we really don't have a lot of people living here anymore.
Oh.
As far as grandkids go, we have two in Anchorage, and we have two in Arizona.
And one in California.
And one in California, correct. We have three in Anchorage. One of our granddaughter, Kippy's daughter, went on to become an engineer, and so she's on the slope.
Oh, wow.
On the slope and in town office, back and forth.
You guys need a scorecard.
I know.
You're listening to the Kenai Conversation here on Public Radio, KDLL. I'm Jay Barrett. I'm joined by my guests this morning. Are Sharon and John Williams, who just celebrated their 50th wedding anniversary. What was the actual day of the anniversary, Sharon?
December the 19th.
December 19th.
Yeah.
And there's a big shindig on Sunday, and I went to it on Monday. They're still talking about it. Well, 50 years. I mean, 1968, you know, we've been hearing a lot on the radio and on TV about what a year 1968 was. You know, John, you're talking about your Kennedy connection. You know, Bobby was killed that year, Martin Luther King, And was Malcolm X killed that year or the year before, I think?
The year before.
Yeah, the Democratic riots at the convention in Chicago that year. And then, of course, Nixon coming back after saying you won't have Dick Nixon to kick around anymore just a few years earlier. 68 was a watershed year, I guess, not just for the country, but you two as well.
Yeah.
Well, yes, and it was a watershed year for Kenai, for the Kenai Peninsula, too, because it was the culmination of a few years of heavy construction out in the inlet with bringing in all the platforms and setting platforms out there. And in 1967, they began the construction of the Collier Carbon and Chemical Plant, and we finished that up in late 1968 and 1969, the spring of it, we finally ran the first amount of product into the warehouse, first amount of urea. I was a supervisor on the instrumentation installation on that project. 1969 saw the start, or let's see, early 68, I think, saw the start of the Phillips plant. And then everything was looking like it was going to go flat. And all of a sudden, out of the clear blue, 1969 and 70, came the Tesoro plant. So I went to work over there for the same company, supervisor on the instrumentation. And we finished that up, and then things did go flat. All of that work on the platforms, all of that construction that was going on, 1,000 construction people living here, and all of a sudden all the jobs disappeared. Not only did all the jobs disappear, but they closed Wildwood at the same time. Mm-hmm. And that shut down all the civilian jobs there and put 30 civilian homes on the market. And about that time is when I went into the real estate business. And I had all these houses to sell and absolutely no one to buy them.
Oh, boy.
And Sharon and I actually contemplated leaving. We did get the trailer already. Everybody lived in trailers in those days. And we were going to go to Anchorage. There was an opportunity there to go to work. So I was going to go to Anchorage and told Sharon, get the place ready. You know, we're going to go, and she'll take it up from there.
We're at the airport in Anchorage, and I can't remember what plane we stopped to look at.
747.
747, okay. And I'm very pregnant, and I had the girls with me, and we're looking out. And John, were you parking the car maybe or something?
Someplace off.
But anyway, so there's this gentleman standing there and he starts a conversation. Turns out it's Tom Wagner.
Oh.
Okay. So he's looking for instrument man, and we're just chit-chatting a little bit, and I'm thinking, So I told him about my husband and then introduced him when John got there. And that was the beginning of the college years. Because you might want to tell the story there.
Now, was Tom Mayer by that point?
No. This was back in 70. 1970.
70, okay. Mm-hmm.
71,
Clayton
maybe.
Brockle was the director of what was to become the Kenai Peninsula Community College. He was running some evening classes down here and hiring adjunct instructors and professors. Tom had been charged by Clayton with setting up the new community college. He was to be the dean. Betty England was to be the support group. And Tom was out looking for an instructor. And as a result of this conversation, which actually Sharon was the one that really brought it all to fruition, I was ready to leave. I didn't want to, you know, get tied up in anything like that. Tom hired me as the first full-time instructor. And I have to say unequivocally, Tom was a changing point in our entire lives because he caused me to leave the field that I was physically working in. He caused me to decide to stay in Kenai. He caused me to become employed with the community college system for the next 17 years. He caused me actually to follow him in politics. He was the mayor prior to me being in. We had served on the Harbor Commission together. Through it all, you know, Tom played a very, very important part of my life and my decisions to stay here. To this day, we're still very good friends. He was at the party Sunday and so forth.
How's he doing? I haven't seen him since I've been back.
Very good. Very good. Yeah, Tom's a little younger than I am, only by about 4 years, I think. But he's doing very well. He and Dorothy, all their kids are raised, of course. And
I was going to say, I still would like to find a bootleg photo of his official mayoral portrait and replace the one that he had replaced in Chambers there,
yes,
right?
Yes.
With the curly hair and the glasses,
yeah.
And the perm. And
yeah. The question was, when are you going to get your hair permed, John?
Never.
Oh, boy. So you were at the airport, Sharon. Mm-hmm. Were you going to fly down here, or you guys had just arrived up there and you were moving to Anchorage?
We went out to the airport to look at the new plane.
Oh, okay. You know, we did that too in 68, I think it was, or 69 or 70.
This would have been 70.
I think it was 70.
The fate of it is that Tom had been working at Boeing when they were building this 747, and he came out to look at the airplane as well. And our only reason any of us were there was to see this new airplane. It was the first 747 to come into Anchorage.
I remember a friend of ours who worked, I think he worked for FAA. We got a tour, and I remember just being astounded that there was a spiral staircase on an airplane.
Yes,
and honestly, it, to this day, it's only one of three spiral staircases I've ever walked on. So it's the weirdest little thing, but they don't have them in those planes anymore. They got just regular staircases now. Yeah.
Maybe a little too dangerous.
Yeah. Well, especially with the lounge upstairs, right? Man. So that was 1970, and then after that you spent 17 years at the college, and then you said this is right when you had started real estate as well. So,
well, I started real estate because the college was a very iffy thing. You know, we kicked it off the first semester, and we didn't have any students. So we had to figure out what to do. We got a delay in the startup, and we finally recruited a dozen students to start the school with. And the second semester was a little bit better. Third became a little bit better. And about the third semester, we got a huge federal grant to start a water wastewater treatment school. At that time, the state had changed its rules in DEC. Every operator in every water wastewater treatment plant had to be certified. And we were bringing on all these little plants in the villages and all these plants up on the North Slope, and the pipeline all had little plants. Every one of these guys had to be certified. So we set up this major program. From that grant, we built the laboratory, the wet laboratory that was in the main building, the first building that was built at the college. And we, of course, doubled it over into an oil laboratory as well, where we could do our oil testing and oil type classes. So that was really the groundwork for the opening and the building and the growth of the college at that time. From there, we branched out into electronics. We branched out into the math and sciences and all the liberal arts classes and things that they have today.
Yeah, you know, you were mentioning about how Tom Wagner sort of changed the direction of your life with you know, going from your profession that you had been trained in, which process technology, instrumentation, that kind of stuff. I've always wondered about that of you. Was that what you learned that in college or in the military? Or what was how did you come upon that?
Well, that was an interesting part of my life as well. I served an apprenticeship as a steam fitter. And I actually started my apprenticeship very early in life. I was 14 years old when I joined a piping gang in a brewery.
Wow.
And that was my first job, and I grew from there. I took my journeyman papers. I was just looking at the certificate the other day. I think I had just turned 21 because I only worked part-time through the years. But really what got me started in instrumentation, I drew a card to go to work in a little chemical plant called Hancock Chemical. Very old. They were the recipient of sulfur residual from the Atlantic Richfield refinery. And they were very old and all rotted out and everything, and they were going to overhaul the complete plant. The day that I got there to go to work, the truck from Republic Instrument was arriving. And they had this great, big, beautiful panel. It was about 20, 24 feet long. Had all these beautiful dials and lights and buttons and whistles and everything else on it. And the superintendent said to me, he said, well, Young Williams, he said, just what have you been working on during your apprenticeship? And I whipped around and I said, stuff just like that. He said, okay, we'll put you in the instrument crew. And that's where it started. And from there, I went on to work for the major instrument companies, Honeywell and Johnson and Powers. Went back east to school several occasions to the facilities back there to be trained. RCA sent me a couple times, and I just kept gaining more and more knowledge and reputation and building. Each step was higher than the last as far as responsibility and knowledge. It finally culminated with the Collier Carbon and Chemical Plant. When I went to work on that one, that was the largest instrument job that I'd ever seen. There were over 3,500 separate items in the instrument package, and we had to identify and install every one of them. It was a creator, let me tell you.
Man. And so that was the skill that brought you to Alaska originally,
with
RCA.
The fellow that hired me specifically for that purpose, taking care of all the automatic control systems at Wainwright and the five Nike sites. That was my first independent run.
Mm-hmm.
Well, even after we were married, you went out for more schooling.
All during my years at the college, in order to keep up with the trade and be ahead of the game as far as the new and latest equipment, I always, once a year, would go out for refresher courses.
Oh, okay. You know, Sharon, I meant to ask you earlier, but we just sort of sidetracked and 45 minutes went on. But so you came up with your family. You're very young. Do you still have family living here?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, from, you know.
Yes. My parents have both passed, but my brother and his wife and family live here.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So you want to give them a shout out?
Ron and Denise Isaacs. They just opened a new business here in town.
I know them.
Magical Gardens.
Yeah, right down the street here.
Right down the street.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's like two blocks from where I live.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
I love those CBD gummy bears.
The CBD, yes.
Yeah.
It helps with pain.
You know, I recommend it. I've got an aunt who's 90, I want to say like 93 or something. Sharp as a whip, but can barely get around. You know, she finally went to a walker. You know, she's old pioneer prairie woman. But lives in Colorado. And I, when I was down there with my brother, I go, have you tried any of these things that are now available? She goes, no, I would never do that. Oh, horrible, horrible. And me and my brother both talked her and her daughter into it, or explained it to them, you know, from experience, and showed them some literature. I think she's doing better now.
Well, I had a knee replacement, and I cannot take pain pills of any kind, no opioids.
Oh, my.
And it was the CBD that got me through. Not THC, but CBD.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the creams, the ointments, and the pills. And it's only gotten better. Now they've got the nano, which is like a little liquid gel cap. And it goes to work instantly almost.
Mm-hmm. You know, the Marijuana Cannabis Control Board here in Alaska is looking at CBD, seeing if it's being sold properly or being labeled properly for sale.
Okay.
I mean, when you buy something at gas stations now, you know,
that's
really
questionable.
Out there in the world for people to use, you know, is it just another herbal supplement, or is it something, you know?
Well, it sure helps with arthritis pain and just pain.
Mm-hmm.
It really, really helps, so. It's been my salvation for that.
Did I ask you where you came? Oh, Washington.
Washington. Colorado. My dad was from Colorado. We lived in Colorado, graduated high school back there. And then he was back to Washington, where they originally came from. When they were married, they lived in Washington. So.
And that's why you pronounce Washington, Washington.
Washington.
You're from Colorado. Everybody from Colorado I know pronounces it that way, and I don't know why.
But
crazy. Then again, my aunt who lives in Denver, I think she has a southern accent too. But she said she's never lived south of Albuquerque. So
who knows?
Yeah. Well, we have about five minutes or so here. you know, there are plenty of there are always questions when speaking with you, John, because great stories and such. But I don't want to dominate the conversation here. Sharon, is there anything you'd really like to talk about? Any records you want to set straight here on the air for the whole community to hear?
I don't know. It's just been a great adventure in Alaska. I've loved every minute of it. My father was in construction, and he was certified with all the government certifications. So we would sometimes move a couple of times a year. And so when John and I met and we got married, it was nice. You know, we've lived here for married 50 years. So
that was the same house for
43 years in the same house.
How much room is he taking up these days with the train set?
One whole room.
That's still a whole room. At least it hasn't grown.
Yeah, no, it's still there.
John, when I left Kenai a dozen years ago and moved to Kodiak, there were no breweries here. And you and I spoke. You'd mentioned earlier that you had got your start pipe fitting in breweries, and you had always had a dream to start a brewery. And you thought maybe when you're done with politics. And by the time you're done with politics, there are four breweries in town just a few years later. And doggone it, that was my dream, was to go to work for you in a brewery.
Yeah, I had planned on building a brewery, putting a brewery together, craft brewery here in Kenai, and I already had the name and picture picked out for the label. I was getting my licensing through the alcohol, tobacco, and firearms people. I was going to call it Kenai Brew, keeping an eye on you from the Kenai. And the picture I was going to use was the boats coming in the mouth of the river. And I had already spotted the equipment down in Tennessee. There was a guy that was selling an entire craft brewery setup. Came in two large vans. He had all the barrels and everything to go with it. We were going to ship the whole thing up here and put it in what is now the Alaska Steel building, where we started the college. That was a 60 by 150 foot building. And things were going along, and all of a sudden these guys walked in the office and wanted me to become mayor. And that kind of closed down the old operation of the first brewery that we would have put in. So.
That was another big change in our life, is when he started politics.
Yeah. Oh, I bet.
Yeah.
So I can't help but think a brewery would have been nice all those years ago, but still, I know that you know, you're talking about getting projects done is one of the things you're known for. We could spend the next hour talking about all of them, but what stands out in your mind as being, you know, like the best thing that you've got for the town?
Well, there's so many. I created a project. I and the council created a project every year I was in office, at least one. Some of the great ones, of course, was the senior citizens' housing facilities. That was a great project. The Visitors and Cultural Center, another really great project. The Fire Training Center, the FAA facilities, the overhauling of the airport. You know, I just go on and on to look at the creation, the negotiations that went into building the new cars market and the Kmart. And secondly, of course, the bringing on the Walmart, Home Depot. The courthouse was another great one. I always say that I won the courthouse at a cocktail party one night, and that could go on for another hour, telling about how we put that one together. So all in all, I'm very proud of the fact that we were able to do all of those things, always as a team effort. The first thing you do when you put together a project is you put together a team. That team is usually those who have a stake in that project and who really want to see it go and want to make it work. And we had wonderful members from the community that served on those teams and did a lot of the legwork and a lot of the push to get it going and a lot of the convincing of others to get it done. And without teamwork, you do nothing. But with teamwork, you can accomplish a lot.
Mm-hmm. You know, usually in the lobbies of pretty much all these buildings that you mentioned, there's usually a brass plaque in there. Mm-hmm.
I say that the reason they put those brass plaques there, that's so they know who to blame when things go wrong.
Well, I was thinking specifically of the one at the visitor center. That's very nice. That seems to have worked out okay. How's the Challenger Learning Center doing these days?
You know, it's still going along. There's been a lot of emphasis lost in the space industry, but it's coming back together again. I still have great hopes for the Challenger Learning Center. I think that it could expand its visibility a little bit. Things are, you know, still out there. There's a lot of other uses that could be applied to it. Right now they have a very good board of directors, and the board of directors has managed to keep it open. Marnie Alcott is running the place, and she's doing a great job there. And I think the Challenger Learning Center will be with us for a long time. It was one of the very expensive projects, and I worked hand-in-hand with Pat Ladner from the Alaska Aerospace Division and with Senator Stevens to put that together, and it will be a good project for many years to come, I think.
Well, you know, especially I think with the increased interest in private spaceflight, mm-hmm. you know, there are probably opportunities involved there. What's the proudest thing the thing you're most proud of here that maybe John accomplished or you guys accomplished together? Kids and grandkids don't count. So
not even his being such a wonderful husband and father.
Oh, that counts. Okay. Sure.
he has been a wonderful father and a great husband. And that's probably his best. Now, if we go political, he was always honest. His word, just his word is like a contract. If he says he'll do it, it got done. And that's a great asset that he has.
You can say nice things about her, too, if you'd like.
Well, she's been my greatest cheerleader, I can tell you that.
Oh, boy. Oh. Well, I want to thank you both so much for coming in. You guys are terrific people and, you know, very special to me, and I'm just so happy to know you both. And it's terrific to have you both in here. John, I've interviewed you, I think I counted it 1 million times. But Sharon, it's great to interview you now.
Thank you. Well.